three discussions we'll be having with President Richard Bjork, Stockton's first president and president from the inception of the college in 1969 to the present. The purpose of the discussions are to create an oral history of the college. We're going to try to add to, rather than simply duplicate, what's available in written material. So interested parties are referred as background for these discussions to the materials that were assembled for the evaluation of the president, and in particular to the preface to the Institutional Self-Study written by President Bjork, and to the materials assembled on the president's stewardship. Dick, I thought we might start with the raw materials out of which a college is built, and I thought we might start with the students in particular. What was the thinking at the time of the inception of the college as to the clientele that the college would serve when they went about the business of putting together two new state colleges? Who did they think was going to come to those colleges, and why did they think they were needed?
Well, in the time the colleges in the 60s were being started, such as what came to be called Ramapo and Stockton, there was a great deal of feeling among people who were involved in college building at that time that if you built something new, somehow just because it was new and perhaps a little different than most institutions, that a quality or a type of student who would come who would be extraordinary, generally in some ways out of the ordinary. In the most simple of terms, most faculty and some staff to these new institutions generally thought that a very high-achieving, highly motivated, independent kind of student was somehow out there in the wings waiting. I unkindly used to refer to that as someone who started a new college thought that they were going to get the students who are currently going to Harvard and Yale, mm-hmm. or were at that time. And many institutions made some very serious errors about the kinds of students they would get, and they hired people who were prepared to deal with those imagined students. Well, those students, as we knew, weren't about to leave Harvard for Evergreen or Stockton or Parkside or Green Bay or all of these institutions that were just coming into being at that time. We spent some time visiting a large number of new institutions throughout the country, and we learned from each of them that those were not the students who were likely to come. We took seriously Alden Dunham's comments in his book about state colleges and universities being the college for forgotten Americans, and that Mr. Dunham's argument is basically that state colleges will draw, have historically drawn, those students who are considered the good, solid average by those conventional measures of ranking class and test scores, that those are the kinds of students who are attracted to state colleges, will continue to be attracted to that. Well, to set everyone's mind at ease a bit, we commissioned a sort of market survey to see what kinds of students were likely to come to Stockton. And that market survey suggested that the kinds of students Alden Dunham talked about would, in fact, come to Stockton. We took that seriously, and our own intuitive feelings were those were the kinds of students who would come. And, in fact, in terms of all of those conventional measurements, those were the first students, with one kind of exception that we really didn't anticipate. And that is, we perhaps made some initial mistakes in projecting the image or identifying what the college was and would be, or at least the way we said it apparently came across to a lot of students that this was a place where they could find all of those things they never could find at other colleges and universities. And they imposed their own imaginations on us. Mm-hmm. And that has happened to many new colleges and universities. So the combination of our own self-expression and students' expectations about a new place and the things that we could do in a new place, and the reality that despite what a lot of people talk about, there aren't many people in the world who are going to select a totally unknown college. They want some currency in the market after they get their degree, and they don't want everyone saying, Stockton what, who, where. They want to be able to say that they graduated from an institution someone knows. And that is a bit of a myth, that people just rush to an institution that is totally unknown. So we did get, in the initial group of about 1,000 students, a large number of people whom I would describe as escaping from some other college environment, mm-hmm. or escaping from some high school or work environment that they found to be oppressive to their individuality. I think it's important to remember in the late 60s, doing your own thing, or, you know, your own bag, and I can do anything I want as long as it doesn't hurt somebody else. Those notions of individual freedom were very, very strong, naive as they are. But people thought that, wow, gee whiz, we'll come to this new place and we'll just do things. And they had perhaps thoughts that have caused SUNY Old Westbury to have such difficulties in getting started. So we did, in terms of achievement level and test scores, generally get the kind of student we thought at the outset. But we got a surprise on the end of the student being very rootless and a lot of I want to discover myself mm-hmm. business, a very low order of self-discipline, and that we'll see had its consequences for the colleges trying to develop the independence of students. But they also turned out to be restless here, and they moved on rather rapidly to the next place where they could find themselves. So, initially they came looking just about as we thought in terms of academic capability.
You described what some of the student expectations were and the rather more realistic expectations of the people who were on the grounds here planning the college. You were involved at that time in the Department of Higher Education. What were the expectations of the people in the legislature and in the Department of Higher Education from when they set about the business of building two additional colleges? Did they take the attitude that these were going to serve roughly the same kinds of students as had been served by the other state colleges? And if so, why build two more? What did they think we were going to get in terms of students? Where was the need?
You, I think, are giving some people a lot more credit than perhaps is deserved, in that people didn't think much about any of those things when they got into the business of, first of all, they were only going to build one new state college. And that one was to be in Bergen County, and that was to be on the basis of support from northern New Jersey for Governor Hughes's $1 billion bond issue to construct new facilities for all kinds of state institutions. So no one was trying to even answer the questions you just raised, or at least no one who had a very loud voice. At best, the argument in those days, remember this planning had to occur 67-ish, and the planning in those days was, look, New Jersey has very few spaces in its public higher education institutions. Anything we created would have a demand. And so I think they were primarily thinking about numbers, and they needed to have more numbers and more spaces for those numbers. So if they thought beyond that, it would be in the Department of Higher Education, which you've got to remember at that juncture was very small and also brand new. Mm-hmm. The chancellor had just arrived, and I had just arrived as the vice chancellor, so that there had been very little in the way of research or planning done. There was no state master plan, so it was responsive to a number of business. It was responsive to some political interests. And as you know, and we've told people often, that the second state college in that bond issue, what has come to be known as Stockton, was added at the very last to the bond issue on the basis of a political arrangement. And Senator Farley, now deceased, had the requisite number of votes that Governor Hughes needed to have the legislature approve the bond referendum. And the price for that support was a college in Atlantic, Cape May or Cumberland County. One knew that that meant Atlantic County in all reality, since Senator Farley at that time was an extremely powerful political figure. And Senator Farley, if you asked him, as we did in later occasions, was interested in providing a service to his region. And his concept was that a four-year college was nice, and we had a need in this area. And he saw it in terms of numbers and prestige. But I think if you had asked any of them what kinds of people will come to these two new colleges, they would say, well, the same kinds of people who go to our other state colleges. They didn't have any different expectations, with the possible exception of the chancellor, Chancellor Dungan at that time, who thought we should perhaps take the opportunity with these two new colleges to try to build a distinguished, if you like, undergraduate public institution to complement the university in New Jersey and get away from the teacher education label that some people thought was a stigma for the other six state colleges. He thought about that a little bit. He wasn't very clear as to where we would get students to achieve that, but he did, I think, influence my thinking a bit in terms of let's take the opportunity of being new to do something that was not a carbon copy of the six existing state colleges. Ramapo did likewise. They took the opportunity of newness to try to do something that was different. But to say that they had a vision or a scheme, a plan or whatever, that simply would not be accurate.
Was there a tension between the view, Dick, that the college would serve primarily South Jersey, which may have been the view of the people who mustered the political support to get the college here, and the view that it would be a quality college that might draw from all over the state? Was there a tension between those two points of view?
There was a strong tension there. You've got to appreciate the fact that three of the initial trustees, all of whom almost, Mr. Hayward has just left the board, but that's Hayward, Alton, and Reynolds from Atlantic County, were initial trustees for the college. Jim Hayward, as you know, had been involved with the Goheen Commission and its resultant Department of Higher Education. And they had all been very active in trying to get more public higher education, and specifically Mrs. Alton had been the leader of the move to have one placed here. And so their expectations were very strongly that it would be a regional college. I would say initially that point of view was joined somewhat by the now deceased Mr. Berry and by Mrs. Leuchter. So the answer is, I think the trustees, not for any particular reason other than they had been active in its development, they were from here, were more interested in, first of all, if not primarily, developing it at a regional institution. Now that surfaced in a very funny way when the most controversial thing that I can recall the board engaging in terms of division on the board was the naming of the college. And they did divide on that very sharply. And the division really was around whether or not it should have a regional or local identification, or whether it should have an identification that didn't say anything about where it is. And if there were ever a tension between the board, I suppose, and that's an exaggeration, but I was the strong proponent of a state college, a total statewide college, of a name that did not identify its location. Now, the board initially was going to call this, the College of South Jersey. That was the original name. And there is something in the law that requires the Board of Higher Education to approve the names of colleges. And I must say, Mr. Taylor, who was the chairperson of the board at that time, and I prevailed upon the chancellor and on the Board of Higher Education to reject the name. And so the name was rejected by the Board of Higher Education, and we went back to the drawing boards, and as some have heard the story, we held a contest for the name, and the two final names that were really seriously considered, three really, Lenape for the Indians around, Carteret for the first governor of the state, and Stockton for the signer of the Declaration of Independence. Two of the names were suggested by a high school student in Lawrence Township and a neighbor of ours when we lived there, who one day walked across the street and said, "Mr. Bjork, I understand you're looking for a name for that new college. Why don't you think of Stockton and Carteret?" So things do happen in funny ways. We got 100 suggestions, 90 of which were ridiculous, but we did get a lot of suggestions on that, and the board finally agreed on a split vote to name it Stockton. And I think that's benefited the college over the long haul in terms of your question about regionalism or service area. And I think the board and the college has been proud now of its status as a state institution and beyond, and not a regional institution. We have very, very carefully avoided being dubbed a regional institution or having a master plan drawn by us or the state which would say, well, we're a regional institution. And that's why the admissions program is aggressively throughout the state and results in our having a good distribution of students.
What was the intent, Dick, in terms of level of previous educational achievement? Was there an element of populism, if you like, to say that this college, that seats ought to be maintained for average students, or was the idea at the beginning that we would take the best students we could get, but that they would turn out to be average?
I think it's it's too generous a description to say we had populism in our mind and set out to pursue that. It's probably more accurate to say that we kind of expected a student who you and others would describe, I think, as having that kind of more populist background. And we were adaptable, and sometimes we make a philosophy out of something that is upon us, and it has a philosophical content after that. But I do think that at least the people involved in the planning of the college and the trustees were well aware that they were going to be dealing with, as is commonly described, the first generation college student, a modest income level, average high school achievement, career and work oriented, and all of that. And that's the kind of student they expected to deal with. And as we get to faculty, many faculty did not expect to deal with that student, but I'm sure that's another point in the discussion.
What about in terms of the kinds of programs students would want? I know you did some research on that at the beginning as well.
Yes.
Arts and sciences as opposed to professional, and what were the initial expectations and preferences of the people involved in that area?
Well, as you know, Bill, it's impossible to get anyone to get me to say that Stockton is a liberal arts college. You know, I almost come unglued at that point because it never was intended to be one. It is not one, and it goes to the point that you're asking. And that is, we did another market survey. We did a couple of them, the one student I mentioned, and we did another that had to do with an analysis of what it is that the students would choose as their courses and their programs and their degrees, because we had a practical problem. We had to hire faculty, and we had to buy books, and we had to do things like that before anyone was here. So we went and did all of this highly sophisticated research. And the research results said that, it would be an undergraduate college with about the same distribution of requests for courses and programs as prevails at Rutgers on the undergraduate level. Very heavily arts and sciences and very modestly professional studies. I disagreed with that research, and probably just on the basis of prejudice or what I thought blowing around in the wind, that I didn't think that was going to fly very high, nor would it fly very long, or it wasn't a very good picture of the future. The trustees didn't believe that either, particularly strong ones such as Taylor and Alton, who had very strong feelings, as did Mr. Hayward, too, about having a reasonable number of professional studies opportunities here. In fact, we held public hearings and gave everyone in the area an opportunity to tell us what we ought to offer. And most of the people came there, of course, to tell you we ought to offer things that would help their careers, their profession, their work. Now, we didn't accede to that. There was engineering, there was education, all kinds of things that we did not accede to at the beginning. But I think, as the literature of the college shows, and all of my sort of statements and corrections of the record indicate that from the very beginning we wanted to make clear there would be, a balance between arts and sciences and professional studies. Now, no one knows what a balance means, of course, and it's movable. And if you mean 50% of each, it's not going to come out that way in all likelihood. But it was clearly to be, in the judgment of the board and mine as the chief administrator, a college with a very substantial amount of professional studies, and that students would come there with that. Well, I turned out to be right and the research to be wrong. It wasn't because I was smarter. It was just because I didn't get all wrapped up in these highly sophisticated instruments. And if you just look at any of the statistics of the government or anyone at that time, the handwriting was on the wall. And we did a terrible thing at the beginning, and that is we hired pretty much in accordance with what the research showed, and we ended up with a lot of historians and a lot of physicists and a lot of people for whom there weren't many students to teach these courses. And this will be part of the story later when you find out what we have to do with the faculty we hired who were not a very good match for what students want. And we starved from the beginning and probably many people think we still do, starve the professional studies as compared to the arts and sciences. But that is a tension, and it continues. And it's only, I think, through the passage of time and the arrival of lots of students who want professional studies and faculty who will support it, that people stop saying liberal arts and at least talk about arts and sciences and professional studies.
We've talked about our original notions in terms of the students, sort of their philosophical dispositions and their the areas of study they'd be interested in and the numbers that would be available. What, if you were to start from that early starting point and think a minute about what major changes you've seen in the development of Stockton student body, if any, since then, what would you focus on? Has it changed significantly, or has it stayed pretty much the same?
We should interject perhaps this point we're talking about students before we get on to that. The college was in its master plan designed, conceptually at least, for 7,500 students, and then that at a later date was scaled down to 5,500 as the demographic information came in and as the state's money got a little tighter. And as you know now, it's about a 4,500 student institution, which it probably will be for an indefinite period of time because no one's going to build a lot of buildings. And the student, the nature of the student body over that period of time, as measured by, the rank and class and the average scores, really they've dipped slightly from the initial group and have begun to creep back up slightly. But throughout all of this, they've been very close to national averages, and that is a consistent pattern. We anticipated having about 60% men and 40% women, and we've had that basically every year, largely because, without being accused of chauvinism, our expectation is we were offering a lot of science-oriented programs, business programs, that historically have attracted more men than women, and that remains true. And the college has sort of stayed on that balance. We have done a much better job of distributing our students throughout the state over time. There were heavy concentrations initially from the Camden, Cherry Hill area. Mm-hmm. In fact, Camden Community College was a major supplier of the initial class. And as an anecdote, you may recall that all of the leadership positions among students in the first year or two were held by Camden Community College graduates. They were the people who were in charge of the students, if you like, at that time. Well, there has been some shifting around. We have now, I think, a better reputation in the Cape May Atlantic Ocean area than initially. There was our initial student population sort of caused a little alarm in the area. Are these the kinds of people who are going to be at Stockton? That has changed. We've now settled down to a point where 25-30% of our population seems to come from that area, and then a good distribution throughout the state. There is only a very small, I think, change over time in the choices of students about what it is they want to do. That isn't, I think, a function of the college. I think it's a function of what's happening in society, and so the career and business programs are getting more play. We have been surprised that we got as many students who are interested in the fine arts as we apparently did, and that has been a surprise area for us. We weren't surprised that environmental studies and marine sciences became as popular as they have. They were at the beginning of the college, they still are. We hope they are substantially more than a fad and that they will develop into, very strong programs for the college. But the student population, I think, changed most over the time in terms of their expectations about what it is the college could deliver for them. And I think, it's a combination of Stockton being consistent in its approach to how students are to be handled and also a general climate change in the society about students being more concerned about what they're going to do with what they're now learning, and they want some kind of application for it. So that students have come to not only accept, but I think utilize more effectively the college for their purposes without getting all wrapped up in those traditional forms of student involvement that we started with in terms of student union type of concern about, you know, how are we going to stop the war in X, Y, or Z, and how are we going to save the world from poverty, and all of that effort to get the institution focused on global issues rather than on working with students directly, to the point where I think we would like to take some credit for the possibility that students now know how to make a system work, an experience that I think will be useful to them when they leave the place, so that they know how to get services out of organizations, whether they be commercial or public. They know how to deal with people, and I think in very recent times we've found students taking the initiative in providing services for themselves as well as for others. That's been a painful road, but I think the independence and self-reliance and self-discipline of students has increased immeasurably. They aren't nearly as impractical in their thoughts, don't have nearly the outrageous expectations that made them frustrated. But I think that's a combination of the institution and the society. And it is an institution, I think, where from the student perspective, that they come here, still come here, because they do understand that it's a place that not only has a lot of individual freedom for them, but it has a reasonable enough structure supported by, you know, very concerned faculty and staff, by and large. And so we're still getting students who look for that, who expect that from the institution. And I think their level of satisfaction is increasing. Attrition is down substantially. Students are now staying with the institution much longer, I mean, much more consistently and staying on to the end than they did earlier. They're not as restless about the place.
Do you think, Dick, one last question on students. There have been some projections that we're in for a very severe enrollment crunch with the end of the baby boom and migration from New Jersey and that sort of thing. What's your expectation, if we can move a little bit out of history into one question into the future, about the degree to which that's likely to hit Stockton, or on the other hand, the degree to which the school, because of some of the characteristics you mentioned, will be do better than the average in terms of attracting and holding students?
I think we'll do much better than the average in New Jersey, at least, in holding and attracting students. Some of the reasons are simple and obvious. We're in an area that's going to undergo rapid development in this state, and other areas are not. And we'll naturally benefit from that rapid development. There's no way of avoiding that. In addition, I think we have a strategy of trying to attract students, which is effective and will continue to be, so that we consciously set out to get students. We are, you know, aggressors in that, if you like. We seek, and that is an advantage that will be eroded as other people begin to follow that lead. We have characteristics of the institution, I think, as you mentioned, and its programs that help, and that is, you know, not distinguishing between part and full-time students, an idea that's been with us from the beginning, trying to have a reasonable distribution of offerings throughout the course of the instructional day, meaning into the evening, without making great distinctions on that part, a great deal of flexibility of students coming in and out of the institution, changing their loads, and all of these that are now becoming somewhat more common in higher education. We have a start there and have some advantage. I think we also will be in a position to respond much more effectively to the so-called non-traditional student, the adult learner, whatever label you want to give those people who are outside of that, beyond 22 years of age or something of that nature. The institution is in a posture to be very flexible, which is a word I'm sure will come up along the way that sometimes has people's hair standing on end, that we have tried to maintain as good a posture of flexibility as possible so that we can make adjustments and adaptations to changing clientele, changing prospects. So I would argue that it would be very, very easy for Stockton to physically grow and have the students. We see that in a small way in housing, where we can grow physically, where we have, you know, nearly 900 students waiting to get into on-campus housing at this time, and that we are in a very severe bind. We will build for that. But the state, in my judgment, is unlikely to agree to expanding one college if other colleges are experiencing enrollment declines. So our success in this area may only produce a kind of an impact on us that says tighten up. Some people, as you can guess, expect, if I'm right, that the demand will be strong, at least as strong as it has been, and maybe stronger for Stockton, that we can, as they like to say, improve the quality of the student who is coming, meaning, aha, that means we're going to get higher scores and higher class rank. There'll be a very, very small part of that, in my opinion. What it really is a shifting of the same kinds of students from other institutions to us. The same kinds, I mean, as we have historically gotten and will continue to get. Because, you know, there's nothing wrong with being average, because that's where most people are. And that's an enormous pool of people. And we will get a bigger share, you know, of that pool than do others, even as it shrinks. And that's not going to turn Stockton into, you know, some kind of subunit in terms of those student characteristics people like to talk about of Princeton or the Ivy League. That's not going to happen, no matter what happens in terms of the student pool. It's just not, in my judgment, in the cards, and it's a wasted kind of effort to continually hark after that goal.
Dick is a bridge into talking about faculty, from students to faculty. I recall, I think, some comments in reports by outside consultants and certainly from some of my faculty colleagues about the concern about the problem that there might have been at Stockton a mismatch between the caliber of students that came and the caliber of faculty who were hired to deal with them, and with resultant faculty disillusionment. Was that a concern in the early planning of the college, and do you think it is a real problem or has been a real problem since the college?
It certainly was a concern, because the college came into being at the time that the marketplace for new faculty improved dramatically from the so-called buyer's point of view, the college's point of view. And so it was relatively easy to get people with credentials from distinguished institutions to come. And many people talked about the prospects for bringing a Caltech PhD to Pomona, New Jersey, to teach a 400 math score student. And that was, you know, a difficult prospect. Now, we tried to offset that by looking for people who had these distinguished credentials, who also had some kind of teaching experience in a smaller institution, often a private institution, but sometimes in a state college, who had not always been in the university environment, which was a very difficult adjustment to make for a university person. We tried also, through, as you will remember, rather extensive interview procedures in the early days, when I think it was like everyone sort of spent all the time in the world talking to candidates, and we were a little bit inclined to think we could psychoanalyze people, I believe, and or we could tell them the true story about Stockton, and they would understand and behave accordingly. And so we did a lot of talking, and as I look back on it, we probably did a lot of selling that we should not have done to faculty, because we never let them tell us enough about themselves, and that we made many mistakes in terms of mismatch. And we means the candidate as well as the college. There were some very bad choices, unrealistic expectations about what could be done on both sides. So there was a fair amount of what I think people will call mismatching. But the other side is that We did find, out of this great group of people, highly credentialed, that far more people could make an adjustment to this kind of environment than most outsiders would have anticipated. We had lots of people saying, that's never going to work. Those kinds of people will not long be satisfied here. Where are the research facilities? Where are the graduate assistants? Where are those brilliant students that they can take under their wings? Well, they said, those kinds of people will not stay, nor will they perform very well. And I think we have had outstanding success in getting a reasonable number of those kinds of people to be successful, to stay. And we even have, I think, a very respectable activity of intellectual professional development nature by faculty that has included students. And so I think the mismatch business is exaggerated a bit, but we did some of it, and lots of mistakes were made. It's offset, in my opinion, by the fact that, which got me into trouble throughout my experience with Stockton, is that if it is a bad marriage, try to identify it as early as possible and deal with it. Release the person, encourage the person to move, or the person, probably the smartest ones of all, would just move anyway. I think the expectation was that we would handle the so-called mismatch, if you like, by having easy in, easy out for the faculty and staff as well as students. That was always a belief and expectation of mine, for which, you know, many a gun was shot in my direction for the lack of stability, that there would be this inhumane, cruel treatment of people. But my focus was on the institution. But the biggest problem is not in terms of the credential mismatch. We were able to deal with the problem of everyone being virtually new and untried at the same time, arriving at the same time in the student group, by taking freshmen and juniors simultaneously. We could bring in a student population that was 50-50, which is what we did, 50% at the junior level, 50% at the freshman level, because, one, we wanted student leadership built in instantly. And that's why Camden County College did so well. But we couldn't do that with faculty. Now, we could get no significant number of senior, experienced faculty for a very simple reason. And that is, they are people who already have tenure at other institutions. In New Jersey, there is not instant tenure. So any tenured faculty person coming to Stockton must relinquish his or her tenure. Now, there are very few gutsy people in the world who are going to say, oh, I'm giving up my tenured professorship at University X to come down here to the Pine Barrens to be part of this great and wonderful experience. And so we had a great deal of difficulty doing that. And some of the few that we did get, I suppose the record shows we probably should not have gotten, because it didn't work out very well. But you're the same people who write those glowing things about the quality of our faculty, and some who say it's a mismatch, also point out one of the early problems with Stockton with its faculty is that it was young, inexperienced, full of exuberance and the like, and we have a continuing but improved situation where most people have nothing to compare Stockton with, and the lack of comparability, going out and say, well, Stockton compared to this, in my experience, is such and such. And so without anything to compare it to, we have had, historically, faculty and staff who paint a picture of perfection. And if we don't measure up to that, we're bad, deficient, in some way, this is not a good place. It's only until, you can get out into the field, work with other people from other institutions, that you have a better sense of what your own is like. And persons like you, who have come from teaching experiences in other institutions, who while here got out and worked with the rest of the higher education community, would have a perspective on the college that's probably quite different, because you can compare it to something. So a lot of our difficulty in terms of people saying this is such and such a place is that they don't know how to compare it. They have no experience that would support comparisons, and that, though, I think has changed, and people now see that despite the fact that it may be a demanding place to work, it is high on the individual reward freedom side of the scale.
Maybe we could get into that, because another thing I think that's been said by outside observers is that the expectations of Stockton faculty, that they would be willing to work with students, that they would be willing to live in an environment without the normal kinds of faculty governance structures, with the expectation that people would turn over in terms of personnel, that would place on the faculty demands that might tire them out, that the faculty would come in exuberant and leave tired in a very short period of time. Were you concerned about that, and do you think that's been borne out, or do you think that it hasn't been borne out?
Well, one of my problems is I probably tend to be a little blind on that subject. I'd be pretty hard to convince that many people in higher education, and even at Stockton, are that overworked, that they're worn down and ground down. Oh, yes, I acknowledge that a lot of people think they are, but that's how they perceive any pressure on themselves. And I really often have disagreements with people because I don't think they demand enough of themselves. And they blame all the demand side of things on someone else, or the institution. And I find people that are accustomed to saying, I'm going to demand of myself all these things, find it not difficult at all, not crushing, not wearing them down. I often argue with people that if they have come to work at Stockton with the expectation that the job is going to be, you know, their way to individualize their growth and have development, that the job was created for them, they're going to be dissatisfied here. My own opinion is that don't worry about that side of the equation. You'll be happy and you'll develop and grow if you provide the kinds of services that we expect you to the student, the clientele, the people you're supposed to serve. And through that, you will get whatever satisfaction that I think goes with work. So that it is a demanding operation, and it does and has worn some people down. I think as people step aside and as outsiders come in, they say, wow, it is a miracle, which is the word that the Middle States Association used. This place is a miracle. So they have to acknowledge that you don't, if they're right, the other observers, that it is in that category of unusual, that it wasn't then done by usual methods or usual people. And they have to be gratified, I think, from the point of view of what they've accomplished. As they look at what's happened and what they've accomplished, I'm sure as they're saying, whew, that was a hard day, they're also saying it was satisfying, rewarding, we accomplished something. And I think this is an institution where people who really want to leave their print on something within the institution can do it. And, you know, I'm not talking to the person who's least successful that way. You know, you are an illustration of the kinds of people who, if they want to do something, you know, you have, it's hard work. You know, you don't get to do it just by walking in and say, wow, let's do this. You get it by working hard at it, but you get to do it. And I think that's the important opportunity for faculty that keeps them alive and interested. I guess I don't have enough sympathy for those who spend a lot of time around the coffee table saying, oh, I am oppressed. I am working very hard. And if you measured the time they spent talking about their oppression rather than doing some work, it probably would be greater in the talk category than in the work category. I'm unimpressed with that argument. If we have driven people out, so to speak, because the work is too demanding and the like, it's probably a good thing and not a bad thing.
Were there pronounced differences of opinion within the administration when the original recruiting was going on as to the kinds of faculty? You know, you talked about the limitations on what the college could do. Were there significant differences of opinion as to what the college should be doing in terms of the kinds of faculty it should be recruiting and the expectations that which should be placed upon them?
Yes. In the arts and science group, primarily the differences existed, and they ultimately that kind of difference and program differences led to the replacement of the initial academic vice president with someone else, because the emphasis was on how a person felt about something, how innovative, if you like, how experimental, words that I have difficulty with because they're said too easily without thinking about the consequences of that, I think, went much too heavily in the early days in the arts and sciences for people who talked in exciting terms, people who others felt comfortable with, words like that, which bother me to this day. And maybe everyone ought not to be that comfortable with one another if it's to be an exciting